This is the Dungeon Master's Handbook. Hi everyone, this is Michael, also known as Chicago Wiz, and this is episode 58, Missile Fire in My Chainmail for OD&D. Hope you're having a great week. So, I just recently listened to Daniel of the Bandit Keeps podcast and YouTube channel, his June 11th episode on Missile Fire and Chainmail, and I wanted to share a little bit about my own chainmail. You may or may not know, he has taken chainmail and he's done some tweaks and adaptation for his own version in his game, and he's released it. I think it's called Unchained. And I've kind of done something similar with how I run combat in my OD&D games, the one for when I'm running the Village of Hamlet, Temple of Elemental Evil convention games, or when I'm doing combat in my duet game with my wife. We've both taken chainmail and adapted it to our own purposes. But it was interesting to hear his last episode because he and I have a different approach on how we do missile fire. And so I'm going to cover that here. I talked about in episode 55 about how I use chainmail, and I covered that I only use the mass combat mechanics, also known as the abstract mechanics, for my version of chainmail. And this mechanic is where you compare the attacking type versus the defending type, an example, heavy foot versus armor foot, and you roll dice based on the number of dice you're allowed to roll, based on the type of figure you are, and you compare results to the table. Now, I don't do the man-to-man combat, and I only use fantasy combat tables for situations where my players would be okay with the possibility of the combat being one dice roll to see who lives and who dies. What's interesting is I'd never really thought about how I handled missile fire because I'm pretty close to the rules as written for mass combat. So, by default, chainmail, as it's written, has a phase of its turn devoted to missile fire. So you take a group of figures, usually up to 20, and you can fire at a target by rolling a single d6 and consulting the missile fire chart. Now, this missile fire chart is divided up into three sections. There's a section for unarmored targets. There's a section where it calls half armor or shield. And then there's a third section for fully armored. Now, the rows are the number of figures firing. And the columns of each of these three sections is basically a coin toss. So, one through two, you're going to look at this number. Three through six, you're going to look at this number. Or, you roll a one through three on half armor and shield, you get this many hits if you roll a four through six. And so you take that information, you look at your target, the number firing, you roll a single d6, you look at the result of that d6, and that tells you how many hits you've scored. And it generally works out that the more that are firing, the more hits that you're going to take. And obviously, if you're firing against unarmored targets, you're going to hit a lot more than if you're firing against something fully armored. Now, there's other chainmail rules regarding rates of fire, movement, indirect fire, cover, and all other sorts of things. But the basics of the mechanic is pretty simple. Roll a d6, look at a chart. Now, for my adaptation of chainmail, I use this missile fire mechanic. I don't subvert missile fire into the melee combat tables like other people do. It doesn't bother me to have a separate mechanic because, it's still basically the same thing. You're rolling dice and you're looking at a chart. And I apply the same mechanic, meaning number firing, whether it's a figure representing multiple men or if it's a figure representing a PC or an NPC. Because on my table, one figure could represent 10 men. And then they're usually firing against another figure of multiple types, but we won't get into that. We're just going to stick to the basics here. So how do I handle then if it's a single PC firing? You know, I've got Norbert the Hero, who's level 4, and he's firing against an orc, let's say. So how do I handle that? Well, in chainmail, when you use OD&D, you can equate certain levels with their chainmail equivalents. So in OD&D, the levels 1 through 3 for a fighter are normal men, or normal men plus 1, plus 2, and so on. And then you get to hero level, and then you at level 4, and then at level 8 you get to superhero level. Well, if you look in OD&D, in the first little brown book, there is an equivalency chart for the fighting capability. And so if a single PC is firing a missile, in order to use the missile fire chart with number firing, I simply equate their fighting capability with the number firing. So, you know, in my example, if I am a hero level fighter, meaning you're level 4, I'm shooting with a number of 4. So if I'm firing at an orc, and you know they probably are lightfoot, which I'm going to rule as half armor and shield, then the hero needs to roll a 4 through 6 in order to score a hit against that orc. So I would look at the line that says 3 to 4, go over, I see that the column 4 to 6 has a value of 1 in it, which means 1 hit, and so the hero would be able to hit and hopefully kill that orc. Now, this also means that if you're a superhero, you are going to be using the 8, the fire, number firing of 8, or 9 to 10, or so on. And so in this same case, if the superhero was firing against an orc and they rolled a 4 or 6, they would actually score 3 hits on an orc, which is more than enough to, you know, kill a single orc. And in that case, I would rule that, yeah, you could take out 2 to 3 orcs, assuming that they were in, you know, a group near each other, within melee range, what have you. Or that 2 to 3 could be equated to hits against a single creature. I've used it this way. I found it works pretty well. Now, a question may come up, though, is, well, Mike, if you're scoring 2 to 3 hits in a single, you know, single fire, if you will, of a bow, what does that mean for the number of missiles? And what about the crossbow, which has a rate of fire for 1 time per round, as versus a bow, which if you don't move, you can fire twice, or even a heavy crossbow, which limits you to every other round? And it's funny to ask that, because in chainmail, as well as the early versions of Dungeons & Dragons, we always say that combat is abstract. And really, a lot of people are talking about, well, melee combat is abstract because it's a series of blows and strikes and parries and such. But yet, when we get to missile combat, we're back to thinking of everything as individual shots. And I find that interesting. Why is that? And it's funny, because I myself hadn't really thought about justifying the idea of, you know, one hit versus 2 to 3 hits. And now that I'm thinking about it, after listening to Daniel's episode, I'm thinking that missile fire can be just as abstract of a concept as melee. You know, we think about somebody using a bow and they quote unquote fire twice, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're only firing 2 missiles. Perhaps this just means that they've had 2 opportunities to shoot at their opponents, you know? And that kind of tracks, because a first level person is only going to be able to shoot so well and so often, whereas somebody that's skilled may be able to get off more arrows per round, you know, and potentially be able to score multiple hits on the missile fire table. So what about crossbows then? You know, if missiles can, you know, if bows can fire twice around, you know, how do you justify abstracting crossbows when they only fire once per round? Well, if I think about it though, and I actually do shoot bows and crossbows, it's a lot of work to reload a crossbow. Now, in theory, yeah, I could probably, reload bolts fairly quickly, but I would wager to bet that I'm probably going to be able to easily shoot twice as often with a bow than I am with a crossbow. So for me, it's easy enough to say it makes sense that crossbows are only going to get one chance to score multiple hits versus a crossbow that's only going to get to fire far fewer because it takes more work to use that crossbow to have to reload it and pull the string back and what have you. And if they score multiple shots, it's not because they're somehow superhuman. It just means they know how to work the crossbow bolt better, and their shots, they took better advantage of the opportunity that they had with the crossbow during that turn in order to land more hits or more effective hits. Now, also, why would someone want to use a crossbow as opposed to a bow in chainmail? Well, we're talking about range. A light crossbow is 18-inch range versus a comparable short bow at 15 inches. And similarly, a heavy crossbow has a hefty 24 inches range, whereas a longbow only has 21 inches. So it's kind of a question of, do you care more about range or do you care more about your rate of fire? That's a personal choice. Now, keeping track of missiles, obviously, resources being an important part of OD&D, I count the number of hits as the number of missiles expended. So if somebody scored three hits in that turn, then they've expended three arrows. Now, if they missed and they shot once, then they've shot at least one missile. If they shot twice and they missed, then they've shot two missiles, and so on. And that's pretty easy. Now, I get that some folks might have a hard time, kind of thinking of missile fire as an abstract combat, and I totally get that. D&D certainly planted the concept of single shots in our minds. And okay, if you really struggle with that and you don't want to deal with someone shooting multiple missiles, that's fine. You can just go ahead and say, well, that missile was two or three or five or six times as effective, reflecting the number of hits against a single target. And that kind of fits with how some people think of standard D&D. And it makes sense that if I'm a skilled fighter using a bow and I've scored three hits on a target, it's not necessarily that I've scored, three separate shots, but my shot was three times more effective because I knew how to shoot it. I knew where to aim for. I aimed for that sweet spot, which is three times as effective in causing wounds as it is in one time. Anyway, let me know what you think of how I handle missile firing in chainmail for OD&D. All right, so I have three call-ins this episode, and I apologize, I'm a bit behind on my call-ins. My first two are from Daniel of Bandit Keeps podcast and YouTube channel.
Hey, Michael. Daniel calling in from Bandit's Keep. It probably doesn't sound great because I'm driving, but just listened to your treasure type episode. Very cool. Lots of good information there. It's funny, in BX, of course, which is my kind of standby, what I go to look for, I think it really explains stuff well. It basically says to use the treasure types whenever there's a monster, but if the monster is not all the monsters, so let's say there could be a total of eight that appear, and you've only got two, then you would just quarter whatever you roll. The exception of that, I think, is if the number appearing is like from one to three or one to four, something like that, then even if you get one, then you get the full treasure, which I think it works. It works pretty well. I've done that. These days, when I'm doing the Dungeon 23, I've been doing, I guess, what I assumed you're supposed to do in OD&D, which is, if it's a lair, I use the treasure type, and if it's just a monster without a lair, then I use the treasure table thing, the little roll-on thing. It's interesting because I also use, right, when it's not a lair, I also don't use the number appearing. I use basically what OD&D says. I talked about this on my podcast. So if you're looking at, like, let's say a minotaur, and it's you encounter it not in its lair, and let's say there's normally, like, the sheet says whatever, 1 to 8, there would just be one unless the party's large. Or if it's, I don't know, you're really deep in the dungeon and the Minotaur's a lower level monster. So, that helps balance it out. Obviously, not so much with dragons. But, you know, dragons are generally 60% in lair. So I've mostly encountered dragons in the lair. And when I don't, I usually make some kind of access point to the dungeon so that when you encounter the dragon there, maybe that's a place it just perches once in a while. So it's not, so you don't need to fight it, right? It's not in your way. You don't have to fight it there. You're only going to fight that dragon if you just really want to fight a dragon and probably lose half your party. Anyways, awesome episode. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for the great call, Daniel. For my OD&D Dungeon 23, if the monster that I'm putting down doesn't have a treasure type, then I also use the rule for double unguarded treasure as appropriate to the level that the monster is on. Now, interestingly, if it does have a treasure type and isn't in a lair, it kind of depends on the monster and how tough it is, whether I'm going to use an unguarded value versus, say, the actual treasure type. And usually I will hew to the treasure types for the more difficult monsters. You know, let's take Wraiths, for example. You know, if my party encounters four Wraiths, Wraiths have a treasure type of E when they're appearing in lair, at least for OD&D, and the number appearing is 2 to 16. So if I've rolled up for four Wraiths, that's a quarter of 16, so I'll award a quarter of whatever I roll up for E. Now, one thing I will keep in mind is I want to make sure that the treasure rewarded is at least equal to the XP value of the race. So, you know, wraiths are 4 hit die. So 4 hit die times 4 race is 16 total hit die times 100 XP per HD. So that's going to be 1600 XP. So I'll make sure that however I'm rewarding it, it's going to be at least 1600 XP. And I, you know, for difficult monsters, I prefer 2 times to 3 times, if not more. That means if the party is extremely lucky with a powerful enough cleric and they made a good enough roll to turn all four wraiths, then they just earned an easy 1600 to 4800 XP and gold pieces, depending on what I awarded. Speaking of turning, when I was making this answer and I was looking through the little brown books, the little brown books actually don't say what happens if you have to roll against the value given in the chart. So example, to turn these same wraiths, a curate, a 5th level cleric, must roll a 7 or better on 2d6. But there's no real indication if it's just one wraith or the whole bunch of wraiths or what you should do and even how long it lasts. Now, however, if you automatically turn or dispel a monster, it specifically says roll 2d6 to determine the number of creatures turned or automatically turned or dispelled. And that's specifically called out. Well, that's kind of interesting. When you go and look at Holmes Basic, which I use to clarify OD&D sometimes because, you know, it was Holmes' house rules for OD&D, he actually does call out that if you are rolling against that number value, then you are affecting 2d6 of the undead, which, you know, that's consistent with the automatic values, and that's what I use. Anyway, we have Daniel again on a second call.
Hey, Michael. Daniel from Bandits Keep calling in. Sorry if the quality's not great. I'm in my car, stuck in traffic. So what better time to call in? A great episode on the various resources. Some of them, as you know, we've already talked before, like Delta and stuff, I've definitely tapped into before. And you know, it's interesting. I think you make a good point. And I came into this really late. Like, I started playing again, I would say, like 2017 or something like that. And I found a wealth of information in blogs, not all about OD&D. A lot of it was just blogs in general, a lot of just like general OSR stuff, if you will. But yeah, the blogs are great. And I was never really part of the main movement, like when Google Plus was big and stuff. I remember it kind of falling apart, you know, people going like, where are we going to go next? So yeah, I kind of missed a lot of that. But man, the resources you can find, it was just funny because when you mentioned, you just go to one of those blogs and then you start clicking around on the links. Yes, that is a wonderful way to find all kinds of great stuff. So thanks for sharing those. The pro boards I've actually used by like searching through them, though I am not a member. Maybe I should become a member at some point, but if they'll have me. Anyways, thanks for the great content. Talk to you later.
Thanks for the second call, Daniel. You know, listening to you about clicking on the various links and blogs reminded me of a resource that I probably should have added. It's not specifically to OD&D, but it is very much geared towards old school blogs, and it's called the Old School RPG Planet. It's a list of blogs that are maintained by Alex Schroeder, and he's put out a wealth of RPG and old school related content and applications, and I've mentioned him before. I'm going to put this particular page in the show notes because it is a great list of dozens and dozens of old school blogs. And if you ever wanted a starting point to finding some of that great old school content, this is it. And that page also is a running, almost like the list where you can see the titles of the blog posts and a little snippet from the blog. It has that as well. And just looking at today for 7:15, I mean, there was easily a dozen or more blogs that were putting out content. So blogs are still alive. All right, finally for our last call, we have Jason from Nerds RPG Variety Cast.
Hey, Michael, Jason here. I realize I never called in on, I think, your last episode, the one where we talked about the D&D sources that you found and how new players are using different media to find different sources and the lost sources. I was familiar with most. There's one I wasn't familiar with, and I just wanted to thank you for pointing those out for people and for doing your podcast and bringing all the great content out that you're doing. So it is greatly appreciated, and I apologize for the late message on it.
Thanks, Jason. Absolutely no need to apologize. I'm so far behind on my listening. I'm now listening to podcasts in my headphones while I'm noodling away at my Dungeon 23 writings. So it's a nice way to keep up, caught up, and to kind of put me in the mood. I'm really commuting so little these days, and commuting is how I listen to most of my podcasts, so I have a feeling I'm not the only one that's alone, being behind. All right, well, that's it for this episode. Fair warning, or rather, Cryptor. Next episode will be an update to my Traveler and Battlestar Galactica mashup. By then, my playtest should be over, and we have two questions. Is this going to turn into a campaign? And am I going to have players for the game I'm running at GameholeCon? I'll let you know in a few days. Until next time, game on.